From the home of the Codebreakers and the birthplace of modern computing, this is the Bletchley Park podcast.
Welcome to the June 2023 episode of the Bletchley Park podcast, Sinclair in Focus. Who chose Bletchley Park, a vacant estate in Buckinghamshire, as the wartime home of the Codebreakers? That decision was made by the man in charge of the Secret Intelligence Service known as C, Admiral Sir Hugh Sinclair. A very public man with a very secretive profession, Sinclair was widely known and well respected. He passed away just a couple of months after World War II began in 1939, but his influence was far-reaching. Bletchley Park Trust is proud to be displaying for the first time a collection of medals awarded to Sinclair throughout his life. This recent generous donation from members of his family formed this year's Object in Focus exhibition. The display is an opportunity to reveal a lesser-known character in Bletchley Park's story and a chance to honour this important and charismatic individual. In this episode, we'll be speaking to Bletchley Park's research officer, Dr. Thomas Cheetham, and award-winning author, Mick Smith, to find out more about C. You'll also hear from me, exhibitions manager Erica Munro, about the new exhibition, and we'll meet members of Sinclair's family to uncover more about the collection of medals on display. Many thanks to Dr. Ben Thompson for voicing our archival documents. This episode, Sinclair in Focus, is looking at Admiral Sir Hugh Sinclair and his life, his background, and we're obviously doing it to tie into the very recently opened display of his medals that we have in a showcase in Block C right now. Tom, can you give us more background about the man himself, his personal life? Where did he come from?
So Sinclair's from good naval stock, I suppose. He's not the product of marriage. He's actually the illegitimate son of Admiral Frederick Seymour. This is the admiral who commanded the bombardment of Alexandria in 1885 during the Anglo-Egyptian War, which is quite a key event in the Victorian Navy's history. And his name comes from his mother, Agnes Sinclair, who is Seymour's mistress, but they had three children together. She inherited all his wealth, despite them being unmarried. And then that wealth comes down to Sinclair. So along with his siblings, he's left very well off. He's given the typical naval education, which is Stubbington House School, right near the Solent, down near Portsmouth. And that produces hundreds of naval officers, many of which become very, very famous and prominent. One who's of particular interest to us maybe is Tony Fasson, who is one of the two officers who is killed aboard U-559 trying to retrieve the four-rotor Enigma. And they do retrieve the Naval Enigma code books, which help Bletchley Park break the shark cipher.
The HMS Petard story.
Exactly. He is of the same school. But as I say, many other famous admirals have the same education. So that's a prep school up to the age of 13. At that point, Sinclair joins the Navy as a cadet and is basically groomed to become an officer. And he joins the Navy in 1886 and moves up the ranks. By 1906, what we know is he's appointed as commander of the Royal Naval Barracks in Portsmouth. So he's basically second in command of the barracks. And this is just after an incident where there's essentially been a mutiny. It's described as a disturbance, but it's a mutiny. What had happened is that on the 4th and the 5th of November 1905, there seemed to have been a problem with the stokers at the base. There seems to have been some unhappiness thanks to the treatment by some of the officers on the base, possibly being left out on parade too long in the rain that evening when they did evening quarters, where everybody goes out on parade. And there is an incident where one of the officers tells the men on the knee, which is an order that's given to seamen when they're using small arms and when they're on the rifle range, essentially, and they have to kneel before they fire. But it seems to have been used in a disciplinary sense to make men kneel in front of the officers so they can be given a ticking off. And the stokers don't take kindly to this, and a group of them appear outside back on the parade ground and refuse to turn in for the night, and then eventually they're made to turn in. But the next day there is basically riots break out. Stokers from the base and civilians from outside the base as well. Windows are broken, things are smashed up. Eventually 120 people are arrested, and the leadership of the barracks are removed, and Sinclair is one of those brought in to restore order, and he seems to do that very effectively. So it seems even at this stage of his career, he's being recognised as somebody who's got leadership qualities.
Mm. Decisiveness and...
Yeah, decisiveness, but also tact and a diplomatic slant, I suppose.
Yeah. And he was in his early 30s at that point as well, so still relatively
young, but he's up and coming, certainly.
Mm-hmm.
By the time of World War One, he's assistant director and then director of what's called the Mobilisation Division. So this is part of the Navy that deals with war planning, but also the supply of manpower.
Mm-hmm.
And obviously very important work going on there in the early part of the war. In 1916, he's appointed captain of HMS Renown, which is a brand new battle cruiser. So he's aboard ship, and Renown doesn't actually see action, but it could have done if there'd been another fleet battle like Jutland. It comes online just after the Battle of Jutland.
Mm-hmm. So he went to sea during war. It's not as if he
wrote
his desk.
He's an operational command of a warship. Mm-hmm. It's a big job.
Yeah.
And does that during 1916, and the following year, he's appointed as Chief of Staff to Admiral Pakenham, who is Vice Admiral commanding the battlecruiser force. So it's another level up the hierarchy again. But again, he's aboard HMS Lion. They head out on patrol from time to time. If there'd been another battle, he would have been in the thick of it.
Mm-hmm.
He's got this really good mid-level staff experience by the end of World War One, and again, clearly is achieving recognition and being noticed by the right people. So just after the war, the moment hostilities cease, essentially, he's being lined up to take over as Director of Naval Intelligence.
Yeah, he makes this move into intelligence, where before he seems to have done staff work and, as you say, the sort of leadership roles, but then there's this move into sort of the future of his career.
There's certainly a flexibility between the different roles. I don't know exactly how he became considered as a candidate for that job, but presumably he's making connections with the people involved in the Naval Intelligence Division. And Reginald Hall, Blinker Hall as he's known, who's Director of Naval Intelligence, certainly knows Sinclair well. And we actually have a letter in Sinclair's own scrapbooks. The National Maritime Museum has Sinclair's personal scrapbooks.
Fantastic.
Lots of indications about what he felt was important in his personal life. And in there is a letter titled, "My Dear Quex, I'm delighted that you are to relieve me," and so on. It's from Blinker Hall about the arrangements for taking over from him. So they're clearly well known to each other. It's a very friendly letter. They have this relationship, and you can see how the personal relationships are clearly very important here in Sinclair making his way into that role. But of course, Blinker Hall knows about signals intelligence. He'd overseen Room 40 during World War One, extremely successful. He's anxious to make sure, I think, Sinclair appreciates that as well and keeps signals intelligence in particular working into peacetime.
So we're talking here about just after the First World War, 1919. We know that this is the very earliest days of GCNCS as well.
Yeah, so Sinclair is Director of Naval Intelligence when GCNCS is set up, and it's placed under the Admiralty with a naval man in charge, who was Alistair Denniston.
Mm-hmm.
And it is generally a naval project because the Navy at this point essentially says that they are the chief consumers of signals intelligence, and they're the real experts in it, and their operation has been the most successful. And therefore, unless they get the whip hand over GCNCS, they're going to go away and found their own signals intelligence agency. So essentially, they get to run the show.
I should also say, for any new listeners, GCNCS is the Government Code and Cipher School, the name of the SIGINT organisation that eventually came to Bletchley Park during the Second World War. So was he long at Naval Intelligence?
He was Director of Naval Intelligence from 1919 to 1921. And then we can see that flexibility again. He moves actually to head the submarine service.
Pings back out doing something different.
So he goes to operational stuff again.
Yeah.
And I suppose in that part of his career, he must have been at a crossroads between the backroom work and the more prominent work, running actual naval operations. But he pings back again to intelligence when he becomes C, so Chief of the Secret Intelligence Service, which is in 1923.
Where does this initial C come from? Does it just mean Chief?
It's a bit of a backronym, so to speak, in that Chief is applied because it's C, but C comes from Mansfield Smith Cumming, who is the first C, and he signs all his correspondence in green ink with the letter C.
Right.
So he becomes known as C, and then all his successors
thereafter
become known as
C.
And I suppose Sinclair, he's only the second C.
Yes.
So at that point, he could have changed it to S.
To S, yeah. Could have been so different.
He doesn't. Already there is this tradition that he must become C. And so he is called Chief, which fits. And again, he's personally selected by the man leaving the role. And in this case, Smith Cumming lines him up about 6 months before he's planning to retire, but he actually dies before he retires, so Sinclair takes over a bit early. But he's being groomed for this role and presumably being briefed quite carefully about the way he needs to take things forward. So again, it's very much about those personal connections with the people at the top of these organisations. And again, Smith coming is a naval man, and there is a feeling that a naval officer has to be in charge of the show at SIS as well.
So Sinclair is in charge of GCNCS at this point. It's in London.
What happens is, as soon as he becomes C, GCNCS had been shifting towards the Foreign Office because mostly it's doing diplomatic code breaking. The Admiralty doesn't really want to pay for it. The Foreign Office is happier too. And the Foreign Office technically oversees SIS. So GCNCS floats around in broadly under Foreign Office control, but it's a bit ambiguous who's meant to be in charge. Then as soon as Sinclair comes in as C, he says GCNCS is under SIS now.
So he's sort of the head of GCNCS.
Yeah. So he's created it, and then he brings the organisation with him when he takes up his new role.
Because people who are a bit more familiar with the Bletchley Park story and GCNCS story prior to that see Commander Denniston as the head of GCNCS. And at this point, he was. Were there two heads? Can you explain the status there, the hierarchy?
Denniston is the head. So he is responsible for the day-to-day running. Sinclair is the director. So he is sort of like the chairman to Denniston's chief executive officer, perhaps. He gets the last word, but he's not, at the end of the day, responsible for the day-to-day running.
To be fair, he's a busy man in charge of SIS.
Yeah, but he had a lot on his plate, certainly. It's an important point to make because we quite often see in documentation that people refer to the director. For example, at the start of the war, when Bletchley Park are about to break Enigma for the first time, they're doing it using these cardboard sheets, which they've been told to make by the Polish codebreakers. And there is a ceremony where the director punches the 2 millionth hole in the sets of cardboard sheets. And a lot of people have said, well, that must be Denniston, but it's not Denniston. It's the then director who is Sinclair's successor, actually, Stuart Mingies.
Right.
Because he's in charge.
I see.
There's lots of references to the director. He's known of among GCNCS as the man who is in ultimate charge, even though day to day, the man on the ground is Denniston.
Right.
When we realise that there is this other figure involved, a lot of the correspondence and a lot of the decision-making starts to make a lot more sense, actually. Denniston possibly is always existing under Sinclair's shadow a little bit. When they set up GCNCS, the choice is between Denniston on the naval side. He's known to be a good codebreaker and effective, but not outstanding. The man on the other side is Malcolm Hay from MI1B, the army organisation. But he's known to be a lot more opinionated and headstrong and a bit more difficult to deal with, even though theoretically maybe more capable. But they go for the naval man, firstly because he's naval and therefore the Navy's choice. But they go for Denniston as the naval man, possibly for that reason, possibly because he's easier for Sinclair to control as a much junior officer.
Yeah. I suppose in the Navy as well, a good commanding officer needs a good XO to deliver the day-to-day workings of things too, and that immediate status and both being naval men means that they would sort of slide into that quite easily.
Absolutely, yeah. It's an effective relationship during the interwar years and up to when Sinclair dies, really.
So with Denniston's role being overseen by Sinclair, what was Sinclair like as a leader overall?
Well, broadly speaking, Sinclair, his attitude is as an empire builder. He does want to have his fingers in all the pies and control everything. He thinks all intelligence really in the UK should be under one person, and that person, conveniently enough, should be him. And he doesn't quite get to the point where he's able to take over any other areas apart from the code breaking. But he is pretty unrepentant about that attitude. So he's interfering everywhere he can, and that includes in GCNCS. And I think you do get the idea that he's a pretty hands-on figure. Mm-hmm. And he's telling Denniston what to do. And people are sometimes able to go over Denniston's head to Sinclair to get things done. So, for example, we have a bit of testimony from William F. Clark, who's in charge of the naval section, GCNCS. He's actually another kind of figure whose light shines brightest mostly in the pre-war era, but he has big impact on how Bletchley Park turns out. Clark says that Sinclair was a brilliant chief who trusted his subordinates and to whom one could go knowing that if your application was wise, and he always investigated fully, you would get what you wanted, be it staff or improvements in organisation. So he's considered an effective leader by the people underneath him, somebody who can get things done and is open to ideas. And he seems to be very well liked.
And a leader that has your back, by the sounds of things here as well, a supportive leader.
Yeah, and very well respected.
Bletchley Park Podcast is thrilled to have joining us remotely from the comfort of his own home,
Historian Mick Smith, the author of The Real Special Relationship, The True Story of How the British and US Secret Services Work Together, and a knowledgeable chap about Admiral Sir Hugh Sinclair. Mick, thanks for joining us.
Oh, it's great. I'm always happy to do something with Bletchley.
I have some questions I'd like to ask you about Admiral Sir Hugh Sinclair and his influence in the intelligence community, which is obviously your area of expertise. First of all, who was Admiral Sir Hugh Sinclair? If you had to describe the man to someone for the first time, what would you say about him?
Well, he was what was known in the early 20th century as a gentleman, which meant that he came from landed money. He had no need to work. He joined the Navy. He worked himself up to being an admiral. He was in charge of naval intelligence. He was the director of naval intelligence. He was immensely clubbable, which was the word they used back then for people who frequented gentlemen's clubs. He loved society. His nickname was Quex, after a play by Arthur Pinero called The Gay Lord Quex. And gay obviously had the much more basic connotations in those days of being very happy and carefree. And that was essentially why he had that nickname, because he just liked having fun, having drinks, socializing with people. But he was also very, very keen on intelligence and intelligence matters. He was quite a short man. He wasn't very tall. One of the guys who met him once he became chief of the Secret Service said he looked rather like an Armenian gangster. But I'm not sure what Armenian gangsters are supposed to look like, of course. But it does give you the idea of someone who was idiosyncratic. You know, he wore brown shoes with blue suits, which was very non-new back then. And he became the head of the Secret Service in 1923 when Mansfield Cumming, who'd set British Secret Service up, died. He was Director of Naval Intelligence, as I said, at the time, and he was in charge of the Government Code and Cipher School as Director of Naval Intelligence. So when he joined MI6, he just took it with him. He took control of the Government Code and Cipher School from the Navy, Naval Intelligence, and took it to the Secret Intelligence Service, as what we now know as MI6 was then called, and is still called, that's formally its name. So he was very, very keen on getting British intelligence all in one place. So there were a number of different parts of British intelligence, much smaller than you would imagine now. Obviously, the Secret Service had stations all over the world, but its staff in London were only 35 strong. Government Code and Cipher School was the biggest actual intelligence organization at that time and only had 73 people. MI5 had 33 people, MI5, the Domestic Security Service, of course. So it was a relatively small organization as a whole, and he wanted to pull it all together under his control. And he got the backing of his successor as Director of Naval Intelligence and the other two service intelligence chiefs, the Director of Military Intelligence and the Director of Air Intelligence, to pull this together. And he met with a committee. He did a lot of lobbying. And, of course, anyone who's seen Yes Minister will know that lobbying in gentlemen's clubs was something that went on back then but still continues into the 21st century. And he managed to persuade virtually everyone that it was a good idea, but he overplayed his hand because he was too forceful, too determined to get his way. And the members of the government committee who were due to decide whether they should have one single intelligence service with him in charge began to think that maybe we do want one individual intelligence service, or we would have done if that's where we were starting from. But actually, we don't really want someone like this man in charge, because he'll be telling us, you know, things that we don't want him to tell us and be too forceful about it. So, long answer to a very short question.
No, it's fantastic hearing some detail about him, because the detail to the layperson is quite hard to find. I was wondering if you could give us a bit more background information about his professional experience. So what were his, in your opinion, key professional achievements during his lifetime?
MI6 has always, actually, throughout his history, been relatively successful. There have been bad moments, of course, in the Cold War and towards the end of the Second World War with Soviet penetration of MI6. But during the 30s, it's interesting to hear the Russians talking now about Britain as their main enemy because of Britain's support for Ukraine, obviously. But during the 30s, America wasn't really in play in terms of Soviet Union and what was essentially the first Cold War, really. And I've been to Moscow, I've seen documents in the KGB archives, and one of them described Britain as the main enemy back then for the KGB. The main target, certainly in the 20s and into the 30s, was the Soviet Union and KGB penetration and also Soviet military intelligence, GRU penetration of Britain, British organizations, the British Communist Party, the unions, the armed forces. And MI6 had people inside the Soviet Union, very, very good agents, right up to the top. Stalin's personal secretary was an MI6 agent.
And to what extent was Sinclair kind of shaping the way these agents were managed, recruited, or run?
It was a classic sort of thing. When he first took over, he got all the heads of department together and told them they simply weren't doing enough and they had to produce more. And they had to make sure that stuff was produced widely abroad, but only the decent stuff was to be sent back. So don't send me the rubbish, send me decent stuff. Well, that's an interesting way of doing intelligence. He wasn't really telling them how to do their job. He was just sort of making clear to them that he was the boss and he wasn't going to sit back and let anything happen.
With Sinclair, he seems to have quite, as you said, quite an idiosyncratic personality. I think he's been described as an empire builder, quite strong, forceful, opinionated. It seems as if that translated through from his personal life through to his professional life as well.
Yeah, it did, definitely. And he oversaw quite a lot of very, very good operations, not just against the communists, also against Nazi Germany, and set up, basically, MI6 and, of course, the Government Code and Cipher School for the Second World War. He put them on very, very good footing. One thing I didn't mention is that the reason he, as an admiral, was put in charge of Secret Intelligence Service was because when the Secret Service Bureau, as it was originally called, was set up in 1909, the judgment was that the Navy should look after stuff overseas and abroad, and that the army should look after domestic security. And Mansfield Cumming was a naval officer. He started a tradition which was actually inherited from the Navy itself, because captains of ships in their log write in green ink. And he started that tradition of writing memos in green ink and signing them in green ink when they were typed. And Sinclair continued that as a former naval officer. And every head of MI6 since has done exactly the same thing.
Nod to tradition there. I approve of that. Someone that works in heritage. As you said, he set up GCNCS as the head of Director of Naval Intelligence. He was C and he was running GCNCS, or the top man at GCNCS, for quite a lot of years, obviously from sort of 1923 when he came in, right the way through to when he passed away in 1939.
Yeah.
To what extent do you think he put his own stamp on the organisation, quite a young organisation, in order that it then developed its own personality going forward?
Yeah, I think he did. He understood that you know, there were different types of people working for GCNCS, that it was particularly in the interwar period and the First World War period, actually, when they were separate army and navy organizations. he recognized that these people had special skills, and that did come with strange characters at times, you know. Mm-hmm. I mean, we all know the stories of people like Dilly Knox, and obviously Alan Turing wasn't from that era, but people like that who had idiosyncratic nature, clearly he had some sympathy with that. And if you look at the records of the people who worked for GCNCS during the 20s and 30s, they all talk very kindly of him. And he had an almost a paternalistic approach to them as things, you know, moved through the 30s. And obviously he was getting older. And of course, he famously bought Bletchley Park in 1938, not just for the Codebreakers, although obviously it became and is synonymous with the Codebreakers. He bought it for his own sections as well. And to a certain extent, that's how the wooden huts started to come about, because the whole of the top floor was dominated by sections from MI6 rather than Codebreakers.
Yeah. And because he wasn't here at Bletchley Park, and he wasn't here for very long once Bletchley Park was established here, he's often overlooked in the Bletchley Park story, despite being almost the father of that situation,
yeah,
purchasing the park and doing those early negotiations, the sort of the struggle between SIS sections and the Codebreakers on site.
Yeah. In the mid-90s, when I started writing books on British intelligence, I set up a meeting with a couple of former MI6 officers. It was an official meeting. MI6 set it up for me. They sent a senior MI6 officer and these two odd boys who'd served during the Cold War but came back in and looked at the time. They didn't have an official internal historian. So these old boys looked after the records and everything. And rather like old men, you go down their allotments. It's in the allotment. But they were fascinating, and they told me that Sinclair had been to everyone. He went to the Navy, went to the Army, went to the Treasury, Foreign Office, to try and get them to pay I think it was £6,000 for the mansion and the grounds, and no one would. So he actually dipped into his own account and paid with a check, and the house was actually registered to him in his name. And then Evelyn Sinclair, who actually worked at Bletchley Park but was actually Hugh Sinclair's sister, she signed it over to the government after he died. There was some controversy around this when the official history of MI6 came out, because the fact that she transferred it over just for, I think it was 10 shillings or something, the transfer payment, you know, you had to pay at the time, was assumed to mean that he hadn't paid for it. But I went back to the old boys and they were absolutely adamant. No, they'd seen the evidence he did.
That's interesting. Certainly here, because we don't have evidence either way, the documents, as with much of SIS history, are not forthcoming. So we've often wondered if was there a slush fund to which he had access, rather than him sort of having to, you know, take the money out of his own pocket. Was there likely to be money that could have been acquired, which possibly wasn't either widely recognised or recorded, which he could have used, even if his name was the one that was put on the land registry?
Well, you know, it's obviously controversial, but all I can say is that these two guys, they were absolutely adamant he paid out of his own account. And that was the way, you know, they operated in those days. You know, he was, as I said, very rich man and had his own money. He needed it. And so he paid for it, presumably assuming that at some point he would get his money back. Obviously, he died in the meantime, and Evelyn Sinclair signed it over to the government for nothing, but she would have known what her brother wanted. They were very close. I don't think there was a slush fund, to be honest.
Perhaps in SIS headquarters somewhere, there is an archive of receipts which we will never know or see.
Yeah, no, I know. It's sad, isn't it, really, that these guys have seen it, but because of the way SIS operates and its rules.
Yeah, so much is secret and so much still to discover. It's part of the fascination, I think, in the part of history that we love and deal with. I had one final question for you, and to some extent you've answered it, but I wanted if you could let us know more sort of concisely, how was he regarded by his peers? How was Sinclair seen by those not so much reporting to him with his sort of eccentric, avuncular kind of approach, but those at the same sort of level that he was? Was he well regarded? Was he viewed with some sort of suspicion? Was he generally embraced by those he worked with?
No, he was very popular as an SIS chief. He got on very well with civil servants and with service chiefs. He was, you know, as I say, clubbable. He frequently would take people out to lunch and fine wines were drunk at his expense. I'm not saying he was bribing people, but
he was easy to get on with.
He was easy to get on with, and he was very, yeah, he was very easy to get on with, and he was genuinely well liked. And he was very successful because, of course, not just against the communists, but also against Nazi Germany. And quite a lot of what was going on was known beforehand. Unfortunately, you know, because of incompetence, some of it was ignored, but that can't be blamed on the people who collect it.
Yeah. Well, thank you so much for taking the time to talk to us about Admiral Sir Hugh Sinclair Mick. It's been eye-opening, if you can say that, about an audio podcast. It's been fascinating. Yeah. Thank you so much for your insight and for giving us a little bit more background to the man himself.
Well, thank you, Erica. It's been fun.
What about Sinclair's personal life? We've heard from Mick that he was quite outgoing and unorthodox. But what can you tell us about his personality or what people said about him?
Well, he's certainly known as a bon vivant, I think is
excellent
the phrase. Yes, so you have this Quecks nickname. The irony is in the play, the Gaylord Quecks. Quecks, he actually redeems himself. He redeems his social reputation and he becomes a better person by the end of the play. I don't know if there's a lot of evidence of Sinclair doing that. But he's certainly known to like the high life. We know again from his scrapbooks, a lot of the material in there is dinner menus, flyers for hotels and restaurants. And you look at some of the names on these menus with seating plans. They are big events with lots of prominent figures, again, from government and the Navy. And in some cases, it's Sinclair himself arranging these events. So clearly that is how he operates.
He's kind of an establishment socialite.
Yeah, exactly.
Wow.
And just some interesting tidbits you pick up in some of the books. He apparently carried a massive crocodile skin cigar case with 100 cigars in it. It was always full. And he would just hand these out, of course.
Amazing.
So imagine him coming in with this under his arm. And he drove what's described as an ancient Lancia sports car, open topped. The oldest Lancias are from 1907. That's when they start manufacturing. And if you look at these cars, right up to the early 20s, so it must have been something like this, they are proper Mr. Toad sort of sports cars.
Oh, wow.
With the open top, the leather upholstery, the big wheels and the mudguards and the sort of radiator grille on the front.
We'll make an entrance car, isn't it?
You can just picture Sinclair rolling up to one of these bright red cars normally.
Yeah.
To go to one of the meetings, maybe wearing a woolly hat and driving goggles. That's what I'm picturing anyway.
Cigar case tucked into the passenger
indeed,
seat.
It would have been an interesting sight to see him arrive at one of these venues. And we know a bit about his private life as well. He is married to Gertrude Sinclair, but apparently during the time he's on HMS Renown, their marriage is already in trouble. She visits him aboard the ship and the crew can hear blazing rows from the captain's cabin whenever she's aboard the ship. So unclear exactly what the issues were there. But they do get divorced in 1920.
Yeah.
And I believe you have come across some contemporary information about the circumstances around that divorce.
I do like looking at old newspapers. And I did find an article in the Times from 1920, which gave a surprising amount of detail about the divorce proceedings between Admiral Sir Hugh Sinclair, who they misname as Admiral, I think it's Francis Paget Sinclair, but we've done some triangulation on the dates and it's definitely the man. It mentions how his wife was discovered in a hotel in Dieppe with another man, a boxer, I believe.
A French boxer.
French boxer, yes. This chap, Nuzare, I think his name is. And it sort of quotes the details that were brought up in court about the witnesses that supposedly saw this man coming and going at sort of various hours of the evening into Sinclair's wife's bedroom in this hotel. And to what extent it was a setup in order to acquire a divorce, we simply don't know. We don't have the context for that. But the fact that this quite long, sort of most of a column of the Times was taken up with these really scurrilous details about Sinclair, his wife, and the boxer and the situation that led to this divorce really did surprise me that her name in particular is being effectively besmirched by these witnesses who are called for to confirm her infidelity. And so it doesn't seem as if it was a particularly amicable divorce, I would say. But again, who knows the background to it?
Yeah, it does seem the timing was fairly bad as somebody in Sinclair's position trying to make even more of a name for himself and kind of increasingly sort of moving through the corridors of power. To be a divorcee is quite embarrassing, but perhaps the feeling was that it may have been inevitable.
Mm-hmm. Or preferable, potentially.
Best to get it over and done with. Perhaps that was, if it was arranged, maybe that was the reasoning, but that's pure speculation on my part.
Well, this is the difficulty, particularly with Admiral Sir Hugh Sinclair. No amazing biography of the man exists, a lovely book containing all of the details, and who knows, Tom, maybe one day you are the man to write it.
Add it to the list.
There's no single source that's sort of gone and found all of these disparate bits of information that helps us piece together this quite private, if I can say that, for quite a public man.
He's quite enigmatic, to coin a phrase.
Yes. Exactly. And he was in a secret position. His role was not widely known, I would say, outside the circles that he moved in. And so it is a bit of a jigsaw, isn't it, where some of the pieces may be missing, some of the pieces may be hidden, some may be lost forever. We just don't know.
We do have a nice bit of detail in his obituary, though, that you also found, and I will read out. The very last line of the obituary says that he was a delightful companion possessed of a fund of caustic humour and entertaining anecdote. He seems like he was the life and soul of the party.
Yes. I love the way his obituary doesn't mention his actual job as well. I think it sort of says he was good at his job, but doesn't say what it was.
No, it does hint at it when it says he was advanced to admiral on the retired list in 1930. I mean, I can't imagine that happened too often to people who were actually retired.
Mm-hmm.
And it also makes clear that he was really well thought of professionally. It says he was himself a master of his profession. He was intolerant of any sort of slackness or inefficiency, which he was likely to castigate with an astonishing flow of forcible language, such as was traditional in an earlier generation of sea officers, delivered without hurry or any change of expression. So he's stony-faced while he's admonishing people. For he was one of the most imperturbable of men, and no emergency ever saw him rattled. Yet he was always appreciative of good service in a subordinate. So again, we get a sense that despite his slightly turbulent personality and his private life, everyone thinks he's great.
That seems to be the impression. And he also seems to be a man of contrasts. He's shouting, he's screaming, he's bellowing, he's imperturbable, he is stony-faced. He has all these different sides to him, which people seem to almost forgive because the general direction of his personality seems to just be charisma. That seems to be the overriding effect that I'm certainly seeing in the sources we've got.
We'll switch roles now, Erica, or at least I won't switch a role, but you will, from interviewer to interviewee, because we need to get your take on Sinclair, which is from our new Object in Focus. Now, what are people going to see, and where are they going to see it when they come to visit?
Yes, let me take my host hat off and put my exhibitions manager hat on and tell you a little bit about some of the most recent work we've done on our displays.
And we're doing this kind of virtually. We're sat up in Erica's office at the moment because the day we're recording this is actually the same day that our new education centre is opening. So there's an awful lot of people around.
And where you've asked me, where is it located? In the thick of it, my friend. This new display, Object in Focus, is a small, but perfectly formed, if I do say so myself, display of the medals of Admiral Sir Hugh Sinclair. And it's right in Block C, our visitor's centre. As people come in, we like to give them a little taste of the sorts of wonderful things that are part of Bletchley Park's collection. And these medals are a recent addition to that. And so what a perfect opportunity to say more about this man, who is perhaps less well known than many other Bletchley Park personalities. So we've had this selection of medals very generously presented to us. And it felt like a great opportunity to highlight the medals, beautifully light them. They glow gently in a showcase.
Well, everything we put in that in Object in Focus is always really well. I mean, it's a very small little part of Block C, but it's beautifully formed, isn't it? It's always nicely displayed. Whatever we put in there, we've had that. It's where we have the Eisenhower letter. We've just had
the Enigma G.
Enigma G. The Rusty Enigma.
The Rusty Enigma, exactly. And we do intend to continue highlighting some of the real treasures from our collection in this display. So this will be, the medals here will be on display for around a year from now, mid-2023 through to mid-2024. And the medals themselves give us an opportunity to learn more about the man. So whilst the object is in focus, there are wartime medals as well as personal decorations presented to Sinclair throughout his life. But that gives us a chance then to show some photographs of the man and put his personality back into the Bletchley Park story in a really prominent way.
Now, object in focus, as we said, you haven't got an unlimited canvas here, have you? You've got to kind of give over the story you want to tell in quite a small, perfectly formed kind of way, don't you? So how do you go around designing that as opposed to how, you know, like when you help to design the intelligence factory? Is it a different kind of thought process, or?
It is a different approach, and this is the cruelty of it, being offered the opportunity to say something about somebody who is less publicly recognised. We have this wonderful opportunity, but then it's a very small area where we can't actually say much because we have to keep it very brief and concise. It is the challenge of creating exhibitions. So what we've done is present three angles to Admiral Sir Hugh Sinclair's life and personality. We say a little in a panel on the wall about him being a naval officer, a bon vivant, and an intelligence chief. More of this later in this episode. But we also have some photographs of him. Now, if somebody said to you, should they know who Admiral Sir Hugh Sinclair even was? Sinclair, the man that sort of set up Bletchley Park, what did he look like? Not many people would probably be able to describe him.
No.
And so what we wanted to do was show him at a couple of stages of his career, both dressed in naval uniform and as a civilian in later life. Right. And to have some familiarity with the man, and so that people, as they're visiting Bletchley Park, have him as a character, I suppose, within the story, that we would then, in our early days exhibition in the mansion, bring you back to him and some more of his work in a sort of little room set of his office.
Yeah.
So obviously the main point of this display, however, is the objects.
And what have we got in there?
So in this showcase, all our visitors will have to walk past. They have no choice. There is a large inset plinth onto which are mounted this selection of medals. And we have 10 medals laid out in this showcase, grouped in certain ways so that each selection of medals tells you a little bit more about Sinclair's background, his history, his personality, his career.
They're military medals, but they're also awards, aren't they?
Yes, there's a whole selection here. Now, none of these, I know often we think medals are going to be an award pinned to the chest of a brave warrior for derring do. These ones are slightly different. So a couple of these medals are from his First World War service, the standards of your usual two that you would see. And then we also have some coronation and jubilee medals. And these really attest to Sinclair's longevity, I suppose. So we have a medal that he received for the coronation of King George V in 1911, but then also the coronation of King George VI in 1937. And this man was a prominent member of the English, the British establishment throughout this entire time. The Silver Jubilee Medal of King George V as well, 25 years of his reign. So Sinclair was present for all of this, serving in public service throughout. But also we have other medals presented to him which speak to the high esteem he was held in by not just government, by not just decision makers, but internationally as well. And also give us a little hint of the work that he was doing of international importance. So we have a Legion of Honour medal, which was presented to him in 1918 while he was a captain in the Royal Navy. And also a Japanese medal, that Japanese being allies or friendly in World War I. And so again, in 1918, for distinguished services rendered during the war, the Order of the Rising Sun, third class medal, was also presented to Sinclair. So at this point, he's getting quite a chest of fruit salad.
Quite a lot of stuff, yeah.
But in addition, we also have medals from his later life, but also from his sort of establishment career.
Yeah.
So he was presented the Order of the Bath, Companion of the Order of the Bath, CB, which is a distinction for civilian achievement, but not just the Companion of the Order of the Bath. He was sort of upgraded later in life in 1935, and he received the Knight Commander of the Order of the Bath.
Yeah.
And this medal is one of those beautiful, big, square, diamondy, shiny ones as well that sort of gets pinned to your cloak as you wear it in your ceremony. And that meant that from receiving that, he could then be known as Admiral Sir Hugh Sinclair. Yeah. And really, he'd made his place in the establishment in 1935 when he was, as we know, head of the Secret Intelligence Service.
Now, these medals have come to us very kindly from his family, haven't they? And a few weeks ago, when we first opened Objects in Focus, you sat down with a couple of members of the Sinclair family to get a bit of background about these medals and the family a little bit, didn't you?
Yes, I had a wonderful opportunity to find out a bit more and put these wonderful objects into a more family context. We have the wonderful opportunity to speak with Kate and Stephen Plowman, who are members of Sinclair's family. Kate, you and your family donated the medals that we now have on display. Can you explain the personal connection that you have with Admiral Sir Hugh Sinclair?
Well, it's my step-grandfather was his son. So Maurice Sinclair met my grandmother when she was in her 20s and then disappeared off to Persia, as it was. Mm-hmm. And she then married my grandfather and they went off and had three children and lived in Dorset. And then when Mum was 18, she was the middle child, she left him and went to live with Maurice in India. She then died in 1972 and he in 1985. And my uncle, Mum's younger brother, had the medals and had them on display where in his house, but he downsized. So he gave them to Mum shortly before she died.
Mm-hmm.
Dad had them up, but he decided that he didn't want them anymore. So they came to us. And I was thinking, we're too far distant. And where do they go? Where are we going to pass them on to? We can pass them on to our sons who weren't very interested. And we happened to come here because he had an elderly aunt who lived nearby and we brought her here. And Sir Hugh's room, we just thought it just made sense that this was the right place for them to be.
Yeah, and we're very, very grateful. Thank you very much. So it's sort of the whole family donated the medals.
It's not just us. There's, the six of us left. And all of us, and my uncle especially, you know, because we were thinking we'd sell them. And then I had a guilty conscience about that.
Mm-hmm.
So he was very happy for us to give them to a museum. And then it just fitted into place that actually this is the place they need to be.
Fantastic. Do you have any family stories about particularly Hugh Sinclair, about what kind of man he might have been or any personal stories?
I don't think anybody who has ever met him, because the children, you know, Mum would have been four, five. She was born in 1935.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, when he died. So I don't think they ever knew him. Maurice never mentioned him. Aunt Evelyn was the one who you'd hear as children. We'd hear about her. And we asked my uncle and he said he only remembers meeting her once when he was about 20. And she was a very, you know, had to mind his P's and Q's and was a very sort of upright lady.
Mm-hmm.
But
Evelyn was Hugh's
sister.
Evelyn was Hugh's sister.
But other than that, there's nobody.
There were some notes, I think, you know, Maurice, he's mainly his father, but there's some notes where he's obviously, you know, connected about their connection to the Seymour family.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, that's going back in history with their naval representation.
Mm-hmm.
But nothing more current.
No, so I'm afraid we haven't got any juicy stories.
On the side of Evelyn, you say she was quite a fierce
woman.
Well,
this is how my uncle sort of remembered her, as being sort of very fierce, and he had to be on his best behaviour and sort of
quite frightening. She obviously outlived Hugh Sinclair. She was his sister. The estate of Bletchley Park, which he had purchased nominally, went to her at the end of his life, and then she passed it to the government that she didn't own Bletchley Park as such, although his name was on the deed, which we have in our early days exhibition. But it is fascinating that the man that we've been able to discover was very outgoing, quite sort of full of life, vibrant, very well-known man. But there's little from his personality, I suppose, that remains in family lore.
Mm.
He seems to have been quite notorious from what we can discover. There's some very interesting stories about him and his personal life, his nickname of Quex. I think that was a character from a play, The Wickedest Man in London. So he seems a bit of a chap.
Perhaps he inherited it from his father, who was known as the Ocean Swell, you know, that a dapper naval officer with a certain reputation. So maybe it passed down in the genes.
Can you tell us more about his father?
His father was Admiral Sir Frederick Seymour, later Lord Alcester, and he was the sort of hero of the Battle of Alexandria, where the Royal Navy sort of had a great success. And he was voted in a large sum of money by the Parliament in recognition and later got a peerage. But he never married. He had Mrs. Sinclair, who was originally born as an Agnes May. I've tried to research the family. There's obviously a class difference, which probably explains why they never married. And he had another mistress who was an actress who he mentioned in the will. But when he died, he left his estate to Agnes Sinclair for her lifetime and then divided it between the four surviving children. The eldest son, Frederick, got 2/5. Then Hugh, the other son, and then Evelyn got 1/5 each. So they're obviously sort of a recognised family, but they just never married. But with the nickname of an ocean swell, some of the cartoons you see in Punch was a very dapper gentleman. Mm-hmm. So maybe it just passed down in the genes.
Probably, yes. Were you always aware of Admiral Sir Hugh Sinclair's connection with Bletchley Park?
No.
Do you remember when you first found out about it?
We brought this elderly aunt here mm-hmm. and saw the room.
That was when you realised?
And that was like, hang on a minute, wasn't it? So it was then that it really hit home.
Goodness me.
Then we brought Dad here about a few years later. Mm-hmm. And he was sort of saying, yes, yes, you know, and sort of. So we'd found out and then we looked at the medals at home and that sort of thing. So what, about children were quite young, weren't they? About 15 years ago, something like that.
Gosh. So there is this connection you're finding out more and more even now.
Yes.
But that sounds very much like us at Bletchley Park, constantly researching and finding out more.
I expect my uncle and things knew more.
Goodness. Well, as you say, public awareness of these secrets is still relatively recent and there's still much more to find out. But those people that can talk about it are either sadly no longer with us or ageing. How does it feel seeing the medals that you have donated to Bletchley Park now on display in Block C?
It's fantastic.
Brilliant. Yeah.
They're there for everybody to enjoy them, make him more visible to people, rather than just sitting at home in a box. Here, I feel that they've come home. Mm-hmm.
And more, you know, they're on display that Kate's mum donated one of his hats to a museum where it was just the hat of an admiral in the storage. I mean, we didn't want the medals to be just the medals of just another admiral in some case in storage.
Here he has a special story and a role.
He's yours. So,
and he's, you know, and you can feel that how everybody appreciates it, which is fantastic.
He was an influential man. He was an establishment man. He was C, the man in charge of the Secret Intelligence Service. What do we know about his contribution to the politics of the time around World War II?
Well, SIS is quite a small organisation, still quite obscure throughout the interwar years. And as Mix talked about, its focus was on the Soviets more than anything else. But during the 30s, it becomes more prominent, and especially in debates about the response to Germany, of course. So going into the late 1930s, Sinclair is becoming more prominent and he's beginning to have the ear of people high up in the government, the Prime Minister and the Foreign Secretary and so on. And it's funny, actually, this is at the point where he starts to wear his Admiral's uniform. He's been Admiral since 1930. But when he became C, he started to wear civvies. He had apparently wore a too small bowler hat that he sort of jammed on his head. Quite a daft appearance by some accounts. But when he's dealing with the politicians, he comes in dressed as an admiral for the gravitas that it grants him.
That's very canny for the optics, I think people would say, of the situation.
Yeah. So again, he's empire building. He's trying to elbow his way in and exert an influence on what's going on in these debates about appeasement and how to deal with Hitler when he's clearly got these expansionist aims. And SIS, as a source of intelligence, obviously, is involved in trying to evaluate how credible the threat from Germany is and how best to deal with it.
And some of that evaluation, the work that he did on that has survived, isn't it? There's documentary evidence of what his opinions were and how he was advising these people in power.
Yes, so there is a memorandum on Hitler, which is issued by Sinclair. Not sure if it was written by him, but he endorses it in 1938. And it's quite a perceptive analysis of Hitler's personality. So I think it does indicate that certainly SIS is not blind to the threat of Hitler in any sense.
Mm-hmm. Memorandum. 20th of December, 1938. Germany. Factors, aims, methods, etc. Hitler's character and political abilities. Among his characteristics are fanaticism, mysticism, ruthlessness, cunning, vanity, moods of exaltation and depression, fits of bitter and self-righteous resentment, and what can only be termed a streak of madness. But with it all, there is a great tenacity of purpose, which has often been combined with extraordinary clarity of vision. He has gained the reputation of being always able to choose the right moment and right method for getting away with it. In the eyes of his disciples, and increasingly in his own, the Führer is always right. He has unbounded self-confidence, which has grown in proportion to the strength of the machine he has created. But it is a self-confidence which has latterly been tempered less than hitherto with patience and restraint.
So Sinclair certainly seems to have got Hitler's number. He is pro-appeasement, but I think the evidence is that he thinks Hitler should be appeased to essentially buy time because he is a threat. He's not one of these politicians who's saying Hitler's a reasonable man, we can probably deal with him. And if we give him a little bit, it will all blow over. He's very, very aware that Germany is a problem. It's going to have to be confronted sooner or later. That doesn't actually mean, though, SIS is a very good source of intelligence about the specifics. So, for example, they do get things wrong quite frequently. They forecast that the Germans are going to carry out a coup in Czechoslovakia in May 1938. And this is way earlier than they're ready to move against Czechoslovakia. And of course, the Munich crisis comes about in September. And the following year, they forecast the German invasion of Holland in early 1939, which of course never happens. And on these occasions, it's not very helpful for the British establishment to be led down the wrong road as far as Germany's capabilities or Germany's intentions. And maybe it lulls them into a false sense of security, especially in the May 1938 incident. They feel like by giving some assurances to the Czechs, they've warded off Hitler. They've forced him to back down. In reality, Hitler was never going to act, so there was nothing to back down from. But the British think they've achieved this diplomatic feat, which turns out to be quite illusory.
Mm-hmm.
On the other hand, SIS does anticipate that Germany is going to go for Czechoslovakia eventually. And they're right about that. And they're right about the invasion of Poland as well mm-hmm. in 1939. So they don't get every call wrong. It's just the details are pretty shaky. Whether any organisation, any intelligence agency, certainly Britain is capable of doing a better job at that point in history, I'm not sure. You've also got the problem that, just like we see with Bletchley Park, intelligence is only good as a customer using it. And I think it's fair to say there are quite a few people in government in the late 30s who are not got full grip of how to deal with Germany. Some of them are too relaxed and some of them are too optimistic. And maybe some of the others are too panicky at times. And Sinclair is trying to give these people the best intelligence he has, his best assessment of the situation. But you can't guarantee that anyone's going to evaluate it as effectively as he's done.
And we're talking about sort of late 38, 39 here. But what we shouldn't, I suppose, forget is also that Sinclair actually passed away in 1939. So how his legacy may have changed had he been around for a few more years at the start of the war, my goodness, how different it might have been. But it wasn't a sort of long lingering illness that led him to mental decline or anything like that. It was that he, in a fairly short period of time, became poorly in 1939.
Yeah, I think just over a few months, he's suffering from cancer. As far as I can work out, it is fairly brief and he doesn't slow down. He remains very, very active. He comes to Bletchley Park actually early in the war to see his codebreakers. He still wants to be involved, but they can tell he's very ill and he's struggling. And maybe not too surprised to hear that when he's died, although for some it does come as a real shock. You know, they think this is a figure who's really the soul of the organisation. When he dies, they can't really imagine how it's going to keep going. How his successor will probably step into his shoes.
Tell us more about the successor. How could anybody step into Admiral Sir Hugh Sinclair's shoes? We know that Stuart Mears was the man selected, but how was that made possible? Was he queued up, ready to go?
The process of arranging the succession is fairly fraught. Mears does get the job in the end. He is Sinclair's chosen successor, and that may be the decisive fact. He writes a letter just before he dies, I think the day before he dies, saying that if anything happens to me, it's quite an odd turn of phrase in the circumstances, but if anything happens to me, Stuart Mears is the man to take over. There is another candidate in Claude Danzy, who is a major figure in SIS. He's actually been putting together something called the Z Organization, which is a completely parallel network of agents in occupied Europe. They've been providing a lot of the intelligence on Germany and Italy before the war.
A human intelligence source instead
indeed, of running these agents. Sigismund Best, who is one of the agents captured in the Venlo incident, is one of Danzy's agents. And that comes at a really bad time when these two agents are captured by the Gestapo. They are tempted in by the idea that they're communicating with opponents of Hitler inside Germany, and actually it's the Gestapo posing as resistors. And these two agents are captured, and that's an extreme embarrassment for SIS. It's an enormous headache for Mears just after he's taken over. It's a reason why he wants to exploit Bletchley Park's success against Enigma to regain his own reputation. maybe it's good for Sinclair's reputation that this all occurred just after he died. And there is another opposing camp in the Navy because they say, well, Danzy and Mingus are both army figures and it should be another naval man. And you were looking into some of the documentation around this, weren't you, and found an interesting name amongst the correspondents here. First Lord of the Admiralty.
That's it. Yes, who had very strong opinions and things to say.
And is implying that SIS wasn't providing the intelligence the Admiralty really needed. And
yes,
that there were many shortcomings in the system that Sinclair put together. And that man was Winston Churchill.
Yes, some interesting early documentation from the naval side.
So they have all these arguments about whether Sinclair was any good and then appoint his man in the end. It's fair to say Mingus was probably the right choice to take things forward, even though he's not quite as impressive a figure as Sinclair was. He leads the organisation through the war. He is, again, director of Bletchley Park, director of GC&CS, and makes that work and fights those fights in Whitehall for resources, which he needs to win, and deserves credit for that. Yeah. So a successful succession, as it turns out.
Yeah, you feel like Sinclair would probably, having been the man at the top of GC&CS for so long, would have known as well about the qualities required. Do you feel that the way that GC&CS developed at Bletchley Park under Mingus then can be seen as part of Sinclair's legacy?
Yes, that's absolutely the way to view it. I think he sets all this stuff in train. He sets up GC&CS. He sort of nurtures it as far as he can, even in the cash-strapped period of the 1920s and 30s. He deserves a lot of credit for it. And he buys Bletchley Park. And I think if Sinclair had lived longer, he would be an important figure in this story. And we'd remember him not just as the person who bought Bletchley Park and then dies. We'd remember him as a prime mover, really, in what Bletchley Park turned into a couple of years down the line. He'd be up there alongside figures like Denniston and Travis and Mingus, obviously. Mm-hmm. He'd be certainly well known amongst people familiar with Bletchley as somebody who deserved a very large amount of credit for its eventual success.
One part of Sinclair's legacy that we talk about quite a lot here, and the bit that we probably get the most recognition for him, is the purchase of Bletchley Park, the actual buying of the site so that GC&CS can be moved here as its war station. Do you think that's sufficient credit to give to Sinclair? Was it a personal choice of his, do you think, to move it to Bletchley Park specifically? And how much of a personal decision was it to buy the place?
Oh, it's certainly a personal decision, yeah. He's the man at the top. He makes these decisions. Mm-hmm. He's clearly has done this all personally, this dealing with Captain Faulkner. We have a hint, actually, in some of the accounts from William F. Clarke again, that Sinclair visits the site personally just before the purchase actually goes through. So he's here on the ground. It's certainly not Denniston's choice. And there are people in GC&CS and in SIS who think Bletchley Park isn't actually that suitable, but Sinclair goes through with it, certainly. Whether it's his own money is the question. I tend to come down on the side that it probably wasn't his own money, because I think Sinclair probably did have access to all sorts of non-audit funds, you might call them, which he could have used for this. And his sister isn't reimbursed at the end of the war. But he's a very wealthy man. He probably did have £6,000 lying around if he really needed it. At the end of the day, we don't have very firm evidence for or against.
No, the evidence, we've mentioned this in a previous podcast, I think it was early days, that we do have the land registry document. We have a copy of it on display in our early days.
So we know who made the purchase in his own name.
Exactly. And the address, I think it's 21 Queen Anne's Gate, which is, I think, known as the flat above the shop, the sort of the official residence of C. So it's sort of his home, it's sort of his official home. So it looks as if it's a personal purchase. All evidence seems to be there. There's the cost on there as well. But actually, what else could he have put on there? You know, Mr. X with no address.
He can't put SIS. SIS is a non-avowed organisation.
Exactly.
But yeah, the point is the fact his name is on the documentation does not mean the £6,000 is his £6,000.
But it doesn't mean it's not as well.
No.
So
it's not evidence for or against.
Exactly.
It remains a moot point. We have this correspondence from just a week or two after the war's broken out. And it seems like this is the point where most of SIS have turned up at Bletchley. Codebreakers have been here since August, but the SIS have just turned up with their secretaries and their chauffeurs and their big cars.
Looking for their office space.
And they take over the whole top floor of the mansion, and suddenly the place is a lot busier. You have Section D running around in the grounds, blowing things up, looking into ways to sabotage stuff and do economic warfare. And the Codebreakers suddenly find it a lot less comfortable. And we have this discussion between Denniston, and he's talking directly to Sinclair, saying, how's this going to work? The accommodation here just isn't spacious enough for us. We're going to have real problems in a few weeks with more recruits arriving. What are we going to do? And Sinclair basically says, we can bring you back to London if you want. But Denniston isn't in favour of that because he thinks getting everyone into the office every day, again, the threat of bombing. London's not being bombed at that point, but there's still an anticipation it might be. Mm-hmm. And that's obviously turns out to be appropriate. And the result of these discussions is that they decide to build more huts. This is when they make the decision, we're going to let GCSEs take over the existing 4 huts and we're going to build more of them. And these become Hut 3, Hut 6, Hut 4, mm-hmm. that we all know so well.
When the alternative is being sent back to London under potential aerial bombardment, yeah. that hut seems not a bad option.
But Sinclair is the man calling the shots on all of this and saying this is how many huts we'll build. It's interesting that Denniston, even at that point, is not being given free rein to make those sorts of decisions himself. GCNCS is still very much under SIS control. Administratively, it will be Captain Ridley of the SIS who's in charge at Bletchley Park right up till 1942 when Alan Bradshaw takes over. That sort of organisation works when Sinclair, as a personal chief, is running things by his own hand. When Mingus takes over and he's got a lot more on his plate, it doesn't quite function so well.
I think on site, I'm going to look a little differently at those earlier huts now when I'm out there wandering around the park and thinking that they're built on the orders of Admiral Sir Hugh Sinclair, a personality who I never really made that connection with.
More broadly, I never made the connection between him setting up GCNCS and bringing it over to SIS when he becomes C and bringing it to Bletchley Park. He does seem a much more prominent figure when you look at his biography and almost overlay it on the history of GCNCS. You can see his influence right through the story.
Thanks to the paid and volunteer staff, visitors and veterans who took part in this podcast. To find out more, go to bletchleypark.org.uk. You can follow Bletchley Park on Twitter, Facebook and Instagram. This podcast is produced for the Bletchley Park Trust by MC Fontaine and supported by Audioboom. If you like this podcast, please leave us a review on iTunes. Thanks for listening, and we'll have more decrypts from the home of the Codebreakers next month.